My name is Matthew Libre, and I am joined here today with Peter Werner. The date is June 7th, 2020, and this interview is being conducted over the phone, the Dartmouth Vietnam Project. I'm calling from Cabin John, Maryland, and Mr. Werner is speaking with me today from Los Angeles, California. I would like to start today by expressing my thanks to you, Peter, for speaking with us today. Thank you.
I'm already enjoying it.
Just to begin, where and when were you born?
I was born January 17th, 1947 in New York City at Leroy Hospital, which is no longer there.
Right. And do you have any siblings? Can you tell me about your family a little?
I have an older sister named Patsy Hansen, who is married to a man named Michael Hansen, who was actually a senior at my the high school I went to, which was Hotchkiss. And then he went into the Marines and was sent to Vietnam, where he served as in a sort of journalist corps in Vietnam when I was a senior at Dartmouth and graduating. So, and then I have a younger brother, Tom, who was the head of a company called Carsey Werner, and they made, among other shows, The Cosby Show and Third Rock from the Sun and The 70s Show and Roseanne, and now he still makes TV shows, but he also is the co-owner of the Boston Red Sox and Liverpool Soccer Football Club, as it's called.
Right.
So that's my family.
Wow. That's great. I mean, sort of all over there, it seems like they're doing a lot of things. That's
yeah.
Really, can you just tell me maybe about your parents or, you know, their experience, where they came from?
Well, my ancestors go way back. I had an ancestor who was the first native-born rabbi in what was then New Amsterdam, and he went on to be the rabbi at George Washington's inauguration. It's quite an august family tree that I have to live up to. My grandfather on my mother's side was a banker who came from Alsace-Lorraine by way of Switzerland and London and became a very successful banker in New York. And my family on the my father's side was in the rag business. The schmata business, as it's known. So those were my grandparents. An ancestor of mine invented the rubber eraser that's put on pencils.
Wow!
So, I'm talking about all over the place.
Yeah.
So, and then I grew up in New York City. I went to an extraordinary boys' school called St. Bernard's, which is still there, and I proceeded to go to boys' schools from first grade to the end of college. And then I went to a boarding school called Hotchkiss, the Hotchkiss School, before I went to Dartmouth. And as you and I have spoken about, the reason I went to Dartmouth was that my father went to Dartmouth. He was the class of 1934. And I didn't get into my other two first choice and second choice schools, which were Yale and Princeton. And I think it was an arrangement with the admissions officer, who was obviously trying to get as many graduates from Hotchkiss into as many Ivy League schools as they could. So he basically decided that I was going to go to Dartmouth. And so I went to Dartmouth with a little bit of a chip on my shoulder, but as the story will tell, I am very grateful that I went there, and I had an extraordinary experience at the school and afterwards.
Yeah. And that's interesting. So I guess based on what you said, so you grew up partially in New York, and then you were a boarding student for high school.
Right.
What was New York like at the time for you? Just sort of socially, what were some things that were going on that you remember?
A very interesting question. Well, to be honest, my parents were, although my father's roommate at Dartmouth became the publisher of the New York Times. His name was Orville Dreyfus. So we actually got two New York Times every day, Monday through Sunday. That way my parents wouldn't have to compete for any sections. And I would say the New York Times is as much of a venerated institution as the Bible is to some people. Speaking of which, my parents were very assimilated German Jews, and so they considered themselves Americans first, and Jews way down the line. So, I was sent to Episcopalian schools where we had chapel 5 days a week at St. Bernard's and 6 days a week at Hotchkiss. And I only identified as Jewish because my parents were kind of not ashamed of being Jewish, but they certainly weren't, they didn't identify particularly as being Jewish. So there was 1 year they sent me to, me and my younger brother, to Sunday school at a place called Temple Emmanuel, which is a gorgeous, beautiful temple in New York City on the corner of 65th Street and 5th Avenue, right across the street from the Central Park Zoo. And our nurse would take us to the corner of 65th and Madison and leave us, and then we would sort of mingle with the crowd, and I would secure some comic books underneath my shirt, and my brother and I would play hooky and go across the street to the Central Park Zoo for the 2 hours of Sunday school, and then we'd mingle back in very, very nefarious at an early age, and then get picked up by the nurse. And it wasn't until the report card came out, and what did us in was that we had the exact same number of absences, which they didn't figure was coincidental. So they decided as punishment that we would not have to go to Sunday school ever again. And so we weren't bar mitzvahed or anything like that. So, but I was very unconscious of any race problems, any political problems. My parents were sort of Rockefeller, because he went to Dartmouth, Republicans at the time. And it clearly wasn't until my years at Dartmouth that I became aware of the problems in the country, the civil rights problems and the political problems. It's kind of ironic because I was one of those protesters who went to Washington and shouted, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids have you killed today?" And I ended up making a TV movie about young Lyndon Johnson that really changed my view of him as a truly tragic figure. And I got to meet Lady Bird Johnson and talk with her. So, but Dartmouth was my sort of coming to awareness of politics in the country. The thing I loved about growing up in New York at the time was two things. One was the drinking age was 18, which meant essentially you could go to bars when you were 16, and nobody seemed to have a problem, and it was pretty safe because you would take a taxi home, nobody was driving. And the other thing was movie theaters. I could walk to a movie theater, to maybe 15 or 20 movie theaters from my house. First run theaters, theaters that had double features, art house theaters. And my parents were quite liberal about, you know, letting us go out by ourselves. So from the time I was about 11, I was free to walk to the, we lived on 72nd Street and Park Avenue. And there was a Lowe's 72nd Street that was literally one street. You had to walk across one street, which was Lexington Avenue. So essentially from the time I was 11, my parents would give me, you know, $25 for a ticket and 25 cents for popcorn. And I would be on my own for, you know, 4 or 5 hours watching, you know, movies like The Ten Commandments or The Hanging Tree, every single kind of movie I would go to. And then as I got into high school, I began to see, you know, Truffaut films and Fellini films and Bergman films and every film that was made, I would probably try to see. And you also had movies on TV. TV is, I'm so old that our first TV was black and white, and there was a show called Winky Dink where you'd put a screen on your television screen and draw on the screen, and that worked well enough until they realized that I was drawing on the TV without the screen. So that was the end of that show for me. But you know, I loved television and I loved the Westerns, and I could sing the songs and still can for, you know, Rifleman and Half Gun Will Travel. And the third thing that I loved was sports, and I loved baseball. And we used to go to New Jersey in the summer to the shore, and I would play. I created a game where I could pitch and hit and against the wall. And sometimes I would go so far as to, on a summer afternoon, go into my grandmother's house and turn on the TV set with a scoreboard, with a scorecard, and I would keep the score of the Yankee games, and I would turn off the sound, and I would announce the games, like Mel Allen and Red Barber and Phil Rizzuto, and occasionally the maid or the cook would come in, and they'd see me, and I'd get quiet, and they'd say, "Don't you want the sound on?" And I'd say yes, and I'd turn the sound up, and then I'd wait till they left, and I'd turn the sound down and announce the games. And so it's a certain pride that my brother both went into television and into baseball in such a big way. But those were the sort of three biggest things growing up in New York. You could also just take the bus anywhere in the city. As long as you didn't go out at night, it was very safe. So I would go to the West Side, where I had my first bagel when I was like 13, and you know, go to all those art house theaters on the West Side. So it was kind of a great place to grow up, New York at the time. And it was kind of coming back from its bad years. Mayor Lindsay was the mayor, and he was very cool and attractive. My sister worked for him in his campaign. So I began to feel a sense of what was going on in the world once I was able to take the bus to the West Side. And New York was just such a great place in terms of international. And you'd hear voices, French voices and Iranian voices and Indian voices as you were just walking around the street. So, I guess I should also mention, if you're interested, Central Park, because I think that's that's heaven on earth. And I was just able to explore every nook and cranny of Central Park, and still, you know, when I die, that's where I'd like my ashes to be scattered.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds like, I mean, it sounds like an incredibly, you know, wonderful childhood in so many ways there. I find it really interesting that you mentioned so many, like, very distinctly American sort of things. The, you know, growing up in New York, the big city there, but then, you know, seeing all these films, seeing Western, going to see movies, you know, loving baseball, and, you know, and Central Park and these, like, pretty distinctly American things. But then also, you know, that New York was a pretty international place, and that sort of helped you to start to see the world a little more, going to, you know, the West End a little bit more. And I find that really interesting. I think.
I mean, I'd also say, you know, my parents dutifully felt that every once in a while they had to travel with us. I mean, it was never a lot of fun, but we went to England and France and Rome one summer, and then we went to Los Angeles one summer, and they knew people who were involved with Universal Studios, so, you know, we came out, we stayed at the Beverly Hills Hotel. There's a story my brother likes to tell about this actor named Jack Hawkins, who was in the Bridge on the River Kwai, and they delivered his breakfast to our room, so we took it over to his room, and he opened the door. He was in his bathrobe, and that was a big deal for us. And we went to Lake Tahoe on the way back, and Lucille Ball was in one of the cabins, and we woke her up in the morning, and she came out in curlers and yelled at us. So I had, you know, a sense of the world in that way. I would also say, as far as my father in Dartmouth, he kind of had a very, very positive feeling about Dartmouth. I think he was the class secretary for many years, although the one thing that felt very bad about was he had wanted to join a non-Jewish fraternity, Psi U, and they hadn't let him in because he was Jewish, and he felt a great sort of sadness about that. So when I was there, he very much encouraged me to join Psi U, which I did, and I got whatever it's called, accepted or whatever. And then after I got there, I realized I wasn't a fraternity guy. So I became known as the Phantom because I was the only senior who did not live in the fraternity. Although they did tap me to write the fraternity play contest that they had every year. And I wrote and directed a play for them, and I was given the award as the best technical director. So it was my one and only theater experience, but it was actually a pretty great experience. But he really did. We would go to Dartmouth Yale games and occasionally Dartmouth Columbia games, and he was very proud of the school.
Yeah. A quick that it's funny that you said a lot of that there, and this is sort of a side thing now. Maybe you'll be interested to hear. I am myself in Psi U.
Oh, really? And your father went to Dartmouth.
Yes, he did. He was not. He actually was, I believe, he talked about his experience, actually, and this is sort of, obviously, sort of a side thing here, and it's interesting to hear about your father's experience being Jewish and sort of the fraternity system there. And that my dad was a part of a different fraternity, which was Delta Psi at the time, but I think it was previously maybe went under a different name, and he talked about them being one of the first fraternities to have any Jewish members, and that was.
Oh yeah.
So I mean, yeah, it's very interesting the way it culturally, you know, the shift.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it sounds like he, you know, your father still had such a positive, warm feeling about Dartmouth, and.
But he was a funny man, because I had a nephew who applied to Dartmouth, my sister's younger son, and he wrote, my father wrote, you know, a letter of recommendation. Obviously, he'd given money every year to the school, and my nephew was not admitted. And ironically, he ended up going to Yale, which is where his father went. And it really pissed off my father, and he stopped giving money to Dartmouth as a result of that. So, he wasn't a very forgiving man when it came to
that's funny.
Do you want me to talk about going to Dartmouth then?
Yeah, I was just going to move into that. I just have one more question sort of about
Sure.
You're growing up in the way, you know, and you said that you traveled and you had, you know, a pretty good understanding of, you know, I said before, pretty distinctly American feelings and being, you know, you said Jewish, but then, you know, American kind of first, and that is sort of a, you know, another characteristic that, you know, wouldn't have been in the front of your mind at all the time. And I think, what do you think it was like then feeling American, but then I'm sort of understanding this sort of international worldview, and you know, what was it like to be American when you saw sort of a broader view of the world?
Well, I think it was a very Hollywood-influenced government painted over very much a 50s, you know, kind of Mad Men time in terms of my perception of America up until President Kennedy's assassination, which happened my senior year. I was actually thinking of this sort of coincidentalness that I graduated in 1968, which was probably one of the most seminal years politically in American, certainly the second half of the 20th century. And my son just graduated from his college, which is Vassar, and in what is now turning out to be one of the most seminal years of political and social revolution in the United States. But I would say that I was naive and optimistic, and you know, I believed that America was you know, full of justice and mercy and leading the world in every way, shape, and form. I was probably more of a Democrat than my parents when it came to that. But even when we would go abroad, of course, we would see the best sights. And we, you know, everybody was, you know, very happy to see Americans when we were in those countries. Obviously, when I went to Dartmouth and I began to understand race relations and our politics, especially with Vietnam, I got a very different view of how America actually was and how we were perceived. So that was a, you know, quite an awakening. Although I would say that Dartmouth was certainly not a liberal bastion in those days, and it was fairly mainstream. Get to the point where of my graduation, where half the class walked out on Jacob Javits speech, but that's, you know, 4 years down the line.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to hear about that, actually. I hadn't heard that, but there's a cool story there. And what was your, I mean, obviously, you got to Dartmouth, what, in 64? Because of your 64.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Vietnam had certainly been on the American horizon, you know, a little earlier than that. And I always like that. I mean, sort of like to know, when was your first recollection of the U.S.'s involvement in Vietnam?
Well, it was, you know, it was interesting. At Hotchkiss, there were no, there was a TV in the common room in each building, but you were restricted from watching television to like maximum 2 hours a day. And even when I went to Dartmouth, there was no televisions. I don't think there were any in our dormitories. So you just weren't that aware of even what was on CBS News. But I would think you'd have to say that CBS News and Walter Cronkite were the barometer of where America was at in terms of international politics and Vietnam specifically. And so it was a very gradual awakening, and we're human beings, and I think most of us are pretty narrow-minded and selfish in terms of how we view the world. And really, it wasn't until it dawned on me and my friends and probably my classmates that we were going to be drafted and be forced to go to Vietnam that we really cared what was happening to the Vietnamese or anybody else. And then we began to read that this war, you know, might not be justified, that the domino theory might not necessarily be the law of the universe, and that the assassinations of presidents and the division of Vietnam, that this guy Ho Chi Minh was actually believed in the American Revolution and believed in the American Constitution, and the people in South Vietnam were you know, capitalists, and as soon as things got bad, they were leaving the country with their money. That, you know, we began to go, this might not be such a good thing. And I think that also led to an awareness of the civil rights movement, which of course was huge at the time, and Martin Luther King and the assassination of Malcolm X and the writing of James Baldwin. You began to be aware of the situation. Like when I was at Hotchkiss, I think we had one African-American, no, not even African-American, we had one black person who was from Africa. So it was a very white and white privileged education that I got. And it was, so by the time I was a senior, I was, you know, registering voters and marching on Washington. But that was a long process.
Clearly something pretty integral happened over that 4 year period. And then obviously that could have been a Dartmouth thing, but it was very definitely, you know, certainly a societal thing. I think many, yeah, you know, generation would speak to that.
But Dartmouth was very divided. I mean, I think one of the most cinematic moments, which I think you actually have a picture of in your Dartmouth Project video, which by incidentally I think is excellent, and I say that from a filmmaker's point of view. But in the spring of our senior year, we'd been having these silent vigils on, I think it was Wednesday, from 12 to 1. All the anti-war students would line up on the green on one side of the walkway, and we would just stand there for an hour in silence. It was a silent protest. And so one of those Wednesdays, the other side, the pro-Vietnam students, and, you know, sadly, a number of them went to Vietnam and either killed Vietnamese or were killed, tragically. But it began to be sort of a thing, like how many people are going to be on the anti-war side, and the pro-war people decided that they would stand on the other side of the pathway facing the anti-war people, and it would be like how many people would show up and which line would be longer. And on that Wednesday, probably almost, you know, probably 90% of the campus, including teachers and staff, came out and stood silently opposite each other for an hour. It's very weird and beautiful kind of ritual. I must say that there were more anti-war people than pro-war, but not, you know, maybe 5% at the most. But it was a stark, beautiful spring day. So it was the contrast between what we were doing in the day and everybody's peacefulness too, stood in, you know, contrast to the war, what was going on in the country at the time.
Yeah, I would love to see this, to have been there.
Yeah.
It seems like for the class of 68, this is really, truly pretty integral. You know, this before the Parkhurst takeover in 69, I think it sounds like one of the biggest displays of, you know, just showing how divided the campus was. And I guess I would ask, you know, was it clear to you before this moment and before this kind of wild spectacle how divided the campus was? And also, were there certain lines along with which people would, you know, make that decision? I mean, were students involved in certain groups?
It's an interesting question, but I don't think I know the answer to it. I mean, I think on the one hand, it was a very, it's a very intellectual problem that was brought home by the fact that when we graduated, we would actually be forced to make life choices. But at the time, there was much less hostility between the pro-war and the anti-war people than there is today between, you know, the left and the right and the blue and the red states. I mean, I never remember any kind of violence or pushing or shoving on campus. And again, it was a very white, school, so that, it was really only after we graduated that Dartmouth began to introduce programs like the ABC program. I remember Dean Seymour was involved in that. But it was very, Dartmouth was very removed. It was not just in New Hampshire and, you know, 5 hours from New York, but it seemed politically very removed from all the warfare, the class warfare and the race warfare that was beginning to come up.
Right. Yeah, it seems, it's interesting though, you know, even being removed as it was, that there were still, you know, people taking a pretty definitive stance there, right? That they were on one side.
And again, I think it was self-interest in some ways. It began to dawn on me, I think somewhere around my sophomore year, that there was a draft and I was healthy enough to have no easy
excuse not to be involved. So it began to be like, well, maybe if I didn't want to go to war, maybe I should do something about stopping the war. Again, I think it's self-interest, but that's when I began to realize I was going to be involved in the shit, and I didn't want to. I didn't believe in what the government was doing or saying. That's where sort of my antipathy to Lyndon Johnson started. And I should mention that one of the most glorious incidents in my life was in the summer between my junior and senior year. A friend and I had planned to go to Europe, just the two of us. And again, white privilege and upper middle class situation. And at the very last second, my friend wasn't going to go. So it was either get a job or go by myself, which scared the shit out of me. But I was a member, I was actually one of the leading members of the Dartmouth Film Society. You should remind me to tell you a story about that. And the head of the Dartmouth Film Society, well, there were really three people. There was Blair Watson, who was the head of the audiovisual part of the school. There was a guy named David Stewart Hull, who was a critic and wrote for Film Comment magazine. And then there was Bob Gitt, who was our head projectionist. Bob went on to become one of the leading proponents of film preservation in the country. Blair remained one of my great friends. And David said, he had a ticket to go to the Berlin Film Festival, which was still West Berlin. And he said, nobody knows me. And this was at a time where you could, nobody was checking passports and stuff like that. So he said, well, why don't you go to the Berlin Festival as me? And, they'll give you a hotel and they'll give you a per diem and you can go to all the movies. And it was like, okay, well, then I'll go to Europe by myself. And I went to London and then flew into West Berlin because that's how you had to do it. And I, up to that point, I was staying in hostels and backpacking. And here I was at the Berlin Film Festival as David Stewart Hull with a pass. And I got to see the Beatles and I got to see Jean-Luc Godard and Roman Polanski. And then, because my nature is to like have a goal, my favorite teacher at Dartmouth, who I noticed was already interviewed, so I started listening to his interview, but I didn't get far enough yet, is a man named Peter Bean, B-I-E-N. And he was the best teacher I had at Dartmouth, and I took every class that I could with him. And one of the things that was so interesting about Professor Bean was that he translated Nikos Kazantzakis. And he said he learned to speak to the Greek language in bed because he had married a Greek woman who spoke very little English and he spoke very little Greek. And so he learned Greek through their relationship. And he taught modern American literature and modern European literature. And I actually ended up taking a seminar with him on Joyce and Kazantzakis, and that's what I wrote my senior thesis on. A digression is that one of the people in this little seminar was a guy named Hank, and Hank was a football player and not very. I think he must have been an English major, but he was the least interesting and interested person in the class. And he got A's all the time. And I struggled and I got B's. And so one day I said to him, Hank, how do you do this? I mean, how do you seem so uninterested and and yet you get A's all the time. You don't seem to work very hard. And he said, oh, you know what? I just developed this thing where I take voluminous notes as to what the professor says. And then I write these papers where basically I rewrite what they said in their lectures, and they love me for it. I thought, that's pretty smart. Hank went on to become the head of Goldman Sachs and the head of the Treasury for Bush.
Wow.
Hank Paulson is his name. So anyway, I went to, after Berlin, I flew to Florence. And then I hitchhiked to Kazantzakis' grave. I hitchhiked down to Naples and then across to Brindisi and then to Athens. And I took the boat to Crete. And the funny story there was I arrived at Kazantzakis' grave, which was my destination, which was a museum, at like 4:45 on a Friday, and the museum was going to close at 5. And I planned to go to the museum, you know, essentially touch the gravestone and then turn around. And it was Friday late, and Monday was going to be a holiday. So I just made it in time, or else I would have had to wait till Tuesday morning. And I went up to the guy, and, you know, he didn't speak English and I didn't speak Greek, but I, you know, made it clear that I wanted a ticket. And he said, he shook his head, no, closed. And I pointed to the sign and said, no, 5 o'clock. And pointed to my watch, you know, it's 4:45. And I said, I'm just going to go in for a minute or two and just, you know, pay my respect and then leave. And he said, no. And I begged him and he said, no. And he closed the museum. And so I didn't get to see the Kazantzakis' grave, and I wasn't going to wait for 3 days. And I just laughed, and it was so Kazantzakian that I would make this incredible trip for this purpose and not get to have my goal. But I made the trip, which was very much like this poem that Professor Bean had us read called Ithaca by Constantine Cavafy, which is one of the most beautiful poems ever written. But I think that trip was also a coming of age for me, because I was, you know, completely on my own. There was another story I'll tell, which was that I was in Copenhagen. I had arrived in Copenhagen and I didn't have a hotel, but everybody had told me when you get to Copenhagen, you just go to the train station, and they have all sorts of people. It's the equivalent of Airbnbs. So I went, I found a place, I called the people, they said, come over. Again, it was Friday, and they told me, they spoke English, and they said that they were going to go away for the weekend to their cottage, and but I was free to, you know, stay in the house. They trusted me. And so I said, great. And they packed up and I went for a walk. And I was walking around the city. And then finally I headed back to their house. And when I got there, I realized I didn't have the keys to their house. And I had about, you know, the equivalent of about $30 in traveler's checks or cash. And I was like panicked, like, what am I going to do? And this was before cell phones, and I don't think I even had these people's phone number. So I was just like, I literally had either sit down and calm myself down or flip out, because being homeless is, you know, one of my deep, dark, fears. And so, the only thing I could think to do was to go to a movie. And there was a art house theater nearby that was playing Sabrina. And so I paid for some money, and I didn't know where I was going to sleep or how I was going to eat. And there was a guy in the theater who was an American, who was going to the movie too. So I went up to him. He was my age. And I introduced myself and I said, I know this sounds really crazy, but, and I explained the situation. And he said, no problem. You can sleep on the couch and where I'm staying and I'll loan you money until they come back. And we've been friends ever since. So movies have always saved my life, so to speak. But I think that that summer was really also a rite of passage, because I began to realize that I could take care of myself. But I also, you began to read the Paris, the European edition of the Herald Tribune, and began to realize that the shit was going down in the United States. And it, you know, by the time I was ready to go back, I really was dedicated to doing something that involved protesting the war, changing the situation in America, and hopefully using movies as my way of telling stories about the problems.
Yeah, and that's very interesting to hear that this, you know, how sort of a, you know, a last minute trip there can have such a lasting impact. So it's very cool to hear a friend there. And one thing I'd ask is, I know you're reading the papers there and you're seeing how else, you know, the other side of the world views, you know, views the U.S., especially, you know, a lot of Western Europe and, you know, especially like France had been, you know, involved in Vietnam, and it's always interesting to take time. But what did it feel like, you know, in person for you as an American introducing yourself, you know, as clearly an American? What were people's responses to that? You know, did it still feel like the America of the movies from your childhood, where people saw the U.S. as, you know, maybe a force for good in terms of, you know, World War II and, you know, and the Marshall Plan and everything that the U.S. had done there? Or did it feel like maybe something else now, that the U.S. wasn't viewed so positively?
Well, you know, you ask very interesting questions that I that are causing me to think about things that I hadn't really thought about. My father was a he had gone to he was in Air Force intelligence in London during World War II, and his job was to brief pilots on their bombing missions. And wasn't until my brother, who has done a lot of things involving veterans with PTSD, was honored by the Army, that they said that my father's, you know, job was to brief these people and then to go out when they flew back and get the information from them. And of course, you know, 10%, 20% never came back. So it was, you know, a very traumatic job that he never told us about. He was a very private person, especially when it came to World War II. So, when I was there, when I was in Paris that summer, it was also a very big time of protest in Paris. But what was interesting is the Jean-Luc Godard and Truffaut and all those people were among the people who were leading the protests. But much like their feelings about Hitchcock and an American film, they loved America. And they were protesting France's and America's involvement in Vietnam, and they were thinking about their own relationship to Algeria and stuff like that. So they were very politically conscious, but they loved Americans. And if, you know, here was an American who was going to the Cinematheque every day, and you know, and I would get in these conversations with these, you know, young men and women my age about Vietnam, but we were on the same side. And so they would have me over to their apartments and we would drink wine and they would smoke cigarettes and, And so it was very exciting and very international and fun. But that they were positive. I mean, everybody still believed in American ideals. They just felt that the country was hypocritical in terms of its practices. But they loved America, and they loved everything about America, especially the movies.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's always an incredibly interesting to hear about. I think you still hear nowadays, it would be interesting right now to be anywhere else in the world to hear, you know, what people think of the United States right now. And, you know, sort of like, oh, this place is imploding, and, you know, even socially and, you know, leadership wise, just seems like there's a lot of unrest. But yeah, I think it always interesting to hear. You like a single American or the idea in general.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I guess sort of heading back home from there, and I think we kind of just jumped right into your experience at Dartmouth, but like, you know, obviously for the sake of just like a chronology like a little bit, when you got to Dartmouth, obviously movies have been a huge part of your entire life, right? And can you talk about sort of just, you know, what you studied a little
bit. Right. Well, again, I arrived.
It talks about the Film Society.
I arrived at the school, a little bit of a chip on my shoulder, and I just broken up with my girlfriend who was down the road at the Putney School. And so I was kind of lonely. And I went to the newspaper, and I said, I'm a freshman, I just got here, someday I'd like to maybe review movies or something like that. What do I need to do? Because I'd heard about my friends who went to Yale, they would spend 2 years doing grunt work before they even write an article. And they said, well, here's the pass to the Nugget, why don't you review the movie, we'll read it, decent, we'll publish it the next day. And they did. And it was, you know, pretty incredible to see your name with a byline, writing movie reviews. And, then I also, went and said, I know how to, expose film. So somebody said, well, why don't you shoot the football films? So I would stand on the top of that stadium. What's it called? Baker Field? On the roof. And I would turn the camera on. It was a wide-angle lens, so it would just be each play. And then I would turn it off after the play. And then I'd get the film developed. And on Monday, I would screen the movie for Bob Blackman and the football team, which I think went on to win the Lambert Trophy. It was a really good football team. So that was really exciting because I never gotten any kind of letter at Hotchkiss. And I also joined the freshman Dartmouth squash team, and I got a letter as a freshman squash player, but I never went on to play squash after that. So it was very exciting because I was involved in all these things. Eventually, I was a stage manager on a production of Once Upon a Mattress with this classmate of mine named Bob Reich, who was the, played the king. And it was directed by a student named Jerry Zaks. Jerry is one of the top Broadway theater directors. And of course, Bob, is Bob, and Bob actually narrated the one film that I made when I was at Dartmouth. So we became friends. But there was a teacher our freshman year named Arthur Mayer, who was teaching the one film class at the school, and I was not allowed to in that class because they weren't letting freshmen. So I petitioned to be in the class through Blair Watson, And I got in, and I became very good friends with Arthur and his wife, Lily, who were two of the most extraordinary people that I'd ever met. They were radical leftists. They were against the war. They would have students come over for tea, and we would talk about stuff that was going on in the country. And Arthur would allow, you know, would take the time at the end of the class for anybody who wanted to talk to him for half an hour. So I went over to their house, and you know, I said, I'd really like to stay in touch with you. And he said, I'd be happy to do that. What a nice person I was. And we talked for about half an hour. At the end of it, he said to me, Peter, I just want to ask you, is going into the film business something that you want to do after college? And I was still a freshman, but nobody had ever asked me that question. And I was very, very excited and to be asked that. And I said out loud, probably quite quietly, yes, I would like to do that. And he paused and he said, well, don't. He said, you're too nice a person, you're too sensitive, and the film business would eat you alive. And I was totally crushed. But I also felt, I'll show you, Arthur. And we did stay friendly until he died. And in fact, my daughter is named Lily after Lily Mayer. So, you know, I really got into film in a big way, and probably that was what I value most from my Dartmouth education. I mean, there was a lot of good teachers and a lot of great education, I'm sure, but it also was not, you know, you had to take economics and psychology and sociology and classes that were pretty general and not very honed to being interesting. So, and there was only one other film class that I took that I was able to take, which was with a man named Maury Rapp. And it was a film production class, and I made a short film, and that was very exciting. But there wasn't a very big film program, but there was a lot of film. And the story I wanted to tell you, I know this is big, has nothing to do with Vista, but I would write film society notes, and we would show most of our films in 35 millimeter. And occasionally, if there was a film that they could only get in 16 millimeter, we would show it. And there was a man who lived about 25, 30 miles from the campus, who was a big film person. And if it was a 16 millimeter print, we would actually one of us would drive the print to his house after we'd screened it, and he would send it back so he wouldn't have to come. So I knew where he lived. And one day he would be the last person to arrive at the film, and he would be the first person to leave. He was very private. So one day, just about closing the doors, I'm passing out the Film Society notes, and I'm closing the doors, and he comes along, and I hold the door for him, and he stops, and he says to me, are you Mr. Werner? And I said, yes, Mr. Salinger. And he said, you write the best Film Society notes. And so he went inside, and I was complimented by J.D. Salinger. And there's more to that story later on.
Well, I was going to say, I only know so many Salingers. And
yeah,
that's incredible.
Yeah.
Pretty high.
Second part of the story I'll tell you later.
Great. Wow, so it's great to hear how, you know, and obviously now that, you know, Dartmouth has a much broader and, you know, sort of more diverse array of classes you can take with film. So it's obviously grown from there.
Well, it was pretty, I mean,
a huge part of your
they would, like Arthur would bring people to school to lecture. And one of the people he brought up was a graduate named David Picker. I wouldn't consider myself a hustler, but I was, you know, if anybody was connected to film, I just, you know, I wanted to touch them or something. I wanted to be around them. So I, after David spoke, I wrote him. He was at president of United Artists, which was, of course, making James Bond and Woody Allen and the Beatles and, you know, some of the best films of the late 60s. And I wrote him and asked him for a summer job, and he gave it to me. So it was my I spent the summer between my first freshman and sophomore year working at United Artists in New York and, you know, screening Bergman films and writing coverage. And it was tremendously exciting. And so, Arthur would have people who were connected to film who had been connected to Dartmouth. And there was a writer named Walter Bernstein who wrote The Front and, you know, some great films. He came up, and then we'd also show films of Dartmouth alumni. There was a guy named Arthur Hornblow who was a producer. So you really got a sense that, I guess it was a sense that for the first time going into film, which was, had always been a secret dream of mine, was possible because other people who had followed the similar path to mine had done it. So it'd be the equivalent of, you know, a black person seeing a successful African-American or reading books that had African-Americans in it and going, wow, you know, I can now identify with this. So I was, you know, I was beginning to identify with film people because of their connection to the school.
Right. Yeah. I know that that's so important. I think having obviously role models and people.
Role models.
Right. They where you can see yourself in them. You know, it's a great way to project yourself into success.
Right.
Which,
exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And what other sort of, political involvement were you in? I know in our previous conversation, you know, before this recording, you mentioned something about the Dartmouth Experimental College and your
yeah.
You want to speak about that a little?
Well, by senior year, I was fully committed to not being drafted. And among other things, I explored every possibility. I explored going up to Canada. I drove up to Toronto and I met with some expatriate. I hate the term draft dodger, but that's what they were called. They were really patriots who were against the war. You also could go to prison, which was out of the question. And that's where I began to realize that I had to do something. And my only choices, the only way you could stay out of being drafted would be to do something which would get you a deferment. I mean, of course, you could pretend to have a bone spur in your foot or say you were gay, which, of course, was at that point, you know, they didn't want anybody gay in the army. So that's where I began to focus on VISTA. My two choices were VISTA or Peace Corps. So I applied to both. And I had a girlfriend, and we both applied to Peace Corps, and we were accepted to go to Uganda to work with people who were blind. Or I was accepted to VISTA and I would go to Chicago. So ultimately decided to do that. But in the spring term, Dartmouth was beginning to sort of open up their course curriculum. And if you taught
in the experimental college, you would teach the class, but you wouldn't have to take another class. And by that point, all of our focus was on what we were going to do after college, and it was spring. And so you had to submit your idea, and you had to submit a curriculum, and then they would either approve you or not. And I said I would develop a experimental film class, and I would bring people to campus, and I would, I would teach a small seminar about movies as I knew it, based on a couple of summers of work and my passion. And I remember one of the classes, we had brought in this pretty big actress named Shirley Knight, who unfortunately passed away in the last few months. And she was she had starred in this movie called The Dutchman, which is a very political story about a white woman and a black man. And it was written by a writer named Leroy Jones, who had changed his name to, I believe, Amira Baraka. And he was one of the great sort of off-Broadway writers. So Shirley came up and we showed the film. And during the film, which I'd seen, and so I was sort of standing at the back, somebody came in and whispered to me something. And then when the film was over, I went up in front of, before I introduced Shirley, and said, you should all know that Martin Luther King was assassinated. So that was the night. So it kind of brought everything together, that film, meeting a movie star, and Martin Luther King's assassination, and teaching, for quite frankly, because that's what I was going to do when I went into Vista.
I mean, it seems like so much happened sort of all at one time there. And that, I mean, do you feel like that's the kind of thing that sort of catapulted on, you know, for you to do what you kind of worked with in the years after, I guess, with Vista and going forward and making movies about sort of the social dynamics of teaching amongst different social groups? Because, I mean, that's wild.
Yeah.
All kind of work there.
You know, very much so. I think also, The kind of movies that were being made in the late 60s and the early 70s, there's a wonderful book called Pictures at a Revolution, which is about the five films that were nominated for an Academy Award in, I think it was 1967. There was one old studio Hollywood movie, and then four films that were defining the direction that American film was going. And I still remember them because it's a wonderful book. I've listened to it a couple times. The one old school film was Dr. Doolittle, which was a 20th Century Fox musical extravaganza that failed miserably at the box office, but still got a nomination. And then from right to left, there was Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, Sidney Poitier and Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, which was, in retrospect, a pretty lame movie. I think it was directed by Stanley Kramer, who had done a lot of very progressive political movies. And this is about a white woman bringing a black man dinner, and but of course he was a doctor and he was Sidney Poitier and stuff like that. But the other three movies were In the Heat of the Night, which really was a kind of a groundbreaking movie, the first one where a black man actually slapped a white person, which brought gasps from the audience. And Bonnie and Clyde, and we know how sort of revolutionary that was, and The Graduate. So American movies in the 70s were really about, you know, there was Hal Ashby movies, and there was about society, and there was Friedkin movies, and there was Coppola movies, and there were, you know, all the President's Men. And so movie making in the 70s was really political in a way that nothing, you know, maybe now Netflix or something like that is doing some of these, but it was a very exciting time, even movies like The Wild Bunch. So it was just thrilling to think about making movies that were, that had a message, that were about what was going on in the country, Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon, Prince of the Cities. So it's just a very exciting time in cinema, and to want to be a part of that was exciting.
Yeah, it seems like it was clearly a, becoming more of a socially
right.
I'm sure it's an exciting time against it. Like so many things, but I think it's a very interesting, cool way to sort of express that and reach sort of a large audience in a way that a lot of other things didn't necessarily, especially if it really became popular.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess sort of transitioning, to your time in Vista, in the end of your Dartmouth career, earlier you had said that at the day of your graduation, many of the students walked out based on the speaker.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it was Jacob Javits was the commencement speaker. The Javits Center in New York is named after him, and he was a Republican, but very much of a sort of a Rockefeller Republican. But he was pro-war, and so we decided to organize. I was a member of SDS. Have you heard of SDS?
Democratic Society.
It's Students for a Democratic Society.
Right.
It started, in Wisconsin or Michigan, and we had a branch. There was a guy named Dave Sinclair, who was a rock and roll guy and went on to start a Detroit rock and roll group. And he was a classmate. And, we'd talk about the war and protest and march on Washington and stuff like that. And so we organized that anybody who wanted to would wear a black armband. And then when Javits spoke, we'd walk out. Bob Reich was our valedictorian. And, tremendous. Our parents were there, and my parents were beginning to be aware of Vietnam. They were never kind of like anti-war, but they also realized that their son might be sent over there. And so they were coming around to a different perspective, as was Walter Cronkite in the whole country. I mean, we weren't that radical. And so when Javits spoke, we walked out, which I consider ironic because my son's commencement speaker online was Jason Blum, who produces all the horror films. But he was very sad that he didn't have a live commencement, and here I was walking out on my commencement. But that's sometimes I'm not sure whether I'm making these stories up, but I'm pretty sure that's what happened. But you can ask Bob Reich about that.
That's great. And, looking back on that, was that something that is that a big impact on your experience? Obviously, it was a tail end. And is it something you look back on now and think that that was, sort of a culminating event in your activism, at least as a student?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, in retrospect, it's kind of a fun story. At the time, even though we were, again, white, you know, we weren't experiencing George Floyd moments or anything like that, or Martin Luther King moments. We were really beginning to see that the American government and American society was corrupt and hypocritical and dangerous. But we also were optimists, and we felt that we can do something to change this. We can stop the war. We can convert our parents. In a sense, we were very romantic because we really believed that collectively we would have the power to do the right thing, even if it cost us some time or, you know, hurt us physically. And at that moment of walking out, I was caught up with what I was going to do a week later, which was to drive to Chicago, to Stark Vista. And I know I was both really excited and really afraid, really scared. I mean, it was one thing to go to Europe, you know, and lose my credit card. It's another thing to go and live in the ghetto, and in the summer of 1968, when after Martin Luther King had been killed, and this, of course, was prior to Robert Kennedy being killed. So it was a scary time. And that's, I think, what I was thinking about when I, you know, walked out. Because sort of this is colorful and this is fun and this is Hanover and this is summer. But in 2 weeks, I'm going to be in the thick of this race and war problem, and that was pretty scary.
Sure, yeah, that I mean, that must have been a huge change, and sort
huge
of
change.
Yeah, and going from there, can you talk a little bit about, you know, the training for Vista?
Yeah, Matt, can you just give me, can you put this on pause for 2 seconds while I just go down to the bathroom a second?
Yeah, absolutely. No worries. So I think when we last, dropped off, we were talking a little bit about your introduction to Vista and what that looks like. Can you bring me through the training situation there?
Well, we went to, I drove to, Chicago, which was probably the furthest I'd ever driven by myself. And, you know, it was, again, very exciting and very scary. We were going to have a week of training in Chicago and then be assigned, to some organization. The way Vista worked, and probably still works, if you, are like a church or a poverty program or homeless or whatever organization, charity, organization, you would apply to Vista for volunteers. You would apply for one volunteer or two or whatever, and Vista would say, okay, you can have four, and we'll pay them. So that it was a good deal for the organizations, because essentially they would get free labor, and Vista would give us a small salary and pay for our housing. And I think there must have been some stipend for food, but you certainly didn't go into it to make money. So went to Chicago. They put us up at the YMCA. And there were men and women, which is only worth mentioning because so much of my education was without women by our sides. You know, we certainly went out with Skidmore girls and Colby Junior College girls and et cetera, but we weren't in classes with them, or we weren't on the line with them. Maybe when we went to a protest march, but it was kind of noteworthy. And the person who I remember talking to us, we would have, you know, morning and afternoon and evening sessions, and they would tell us where we're going to go and what kind of organizations, but they would also talk about organizing. And the person who spoke was a man named Saul Alinsky. And if you look him up, he was really one of the leaders in community organizations. I think he was kind of somebody that Obama, I don't know if Obama knew him personally, but being an organizer in Chicago and Obama's background, he had a lot of reverence for Saul Alinsky. And Alinsky was a little bit of a sort of a rock star. So it was, you know, hounded by the FBI and, you know, considered a sort of a commie. But it was kind of exciting being in that atmosphere with all these other men and women who were really dedicated, putting their lives on the line to change, you know, American society. Another guy and a couple were sent to Dayton, Ohio, and to a Calvinistic church, in black church in the ghetto of Dayton. So we drove down there and started our work. Dayton surprised me because I've always thought that Ohio was kind of a northern liberal state, which of course not, went overwhelmingly for Trump. But Dayton, I didn't realize, was really like a southern city. I mean, it's not that many miles from the Mason-Dixon line. And in that summer, it was like I was really seeing firsthand Jim Crow and racism, even though it was in a, quote, northern city. One of the things that I did for pleasure or to just get out of the ghetto was I became friendly with an African-American man who was attending Antioch College. And Antioch, which is in Yellow Springs, which is Ohio, which is very close to Dayton, was one of the great liberal schools in America. And I met this guy, and we talked at a certain point about what are you going to do after Vista, because Vista was only a year, and if your deferment ran out, you would be drafted. So it was still, I was already thinking, you know, what would I do? And he mentioned that Antioch had a graduate school in teaching called Antioch Putney, and that if I got into that and I taught, then I could have another year of deferment. So that planted that in my mind. It was summer of 1968, early, it was June, and hot. And the pastor said to me, you know, I want you to come up with some programs for some of the kids in our congregation. What could you think of doing? Well, at Dartmouth, I had taken pictures for the newspaper, and I knew I had a Nikon and a few lenses, and I knew how to take and develop film myself. So I said to him, what if I start a little project? I go to the camera stores and see if I can get some Kodak Brownie cameras, cheap cameras, and some slide film, and give them to the kids, and we'll do a little kind of seminar on photography, and their assignment will be to take pictures of their lives, and then when we can take some time and take the slides and put them into a slideshow and
put music, Motown was huge at the time, and, you know, get some Stevie Wonder music and Motown music. And I'll try to set up meetings with the with some liberal organizations around the city in the suburbs. And then I'll take the kids and the slideshows to the community groups and have a talk between the sort of white suburban liberals and our kids. And he thought that was a fantastic idea. So I went about it and I got the cameras donated. I got the slide film donated and we began to shoot our pictures and we'd look at the pictures and we'd talk about their lives and they take more pictures and put together a pretty great slideshow. And this took about 3 or 4 weeks. And then we were ready to go to the suburbs. And it was, our first meeting was at a place called, in a place called Wright-Patterson, which is an Air Force base. And we set up this meeting and I drove some of the kids and the pastor drove some of the kids. And we had this like 2-hour meeting with these very lovely, sincere, white, middle-aged people who were very concerned about race in America and the war. And it was just fantastic. These kids had, some of them had never been out of the ghetto. Some of them had never had anything that they'd ever done be appreciated. And they were showing their work and it was fun. And, you know, there were comic pictures and there were serious pictures. And the people from Wright-Patterson said, you know, let's stay in touch. We'll come in and visit you. You come out here on the weekends. It was just fantastic. Drove back, felt terrific. The next morning, the pastor knocked on the door and he looked really stressed and he said, look, you guys got to get out of here. The Ku Klux Klan heard about what you're doing and they think that you're exporting the revolution to the ghetto. And the Klan was pretty big in Indiana, Ohio, had always been big. And he said, I just don't want any problems. So literally that day we packed up and I guess Vista had been contacted and they said, get them out of there. And we were sent to Detroit, which was out of the frying pan into the fire, because Detroit had one of the worst burnings after Martin Luther King had been killed, which had actually led to the murder of some some blacks in something that's called the Algiers Motel incident, which was turned into a book by John Hersey and recently a movie called Detroit. So it was a hot town summer in the city in 1968. And we were sent to, the two of us, we were split up, the four of us were split up. I went initially to a Catholic, agency, but they only had like a month left on their Vista contract. So then afterwards I was sent to a Lutheran, community organization, which was on Meadowbrook Avenue in Detroit, which is a block from the river. And it's down near where there's a very famous club called the Rooster Tail, where all the Motown groups would, the Temptations and the Four Tops and the Smokey Robinson and the Supremes and Martha and the Vandellas and everybody would sing. But it was the heart of the ghetto. And my job was to run the community organization and to teach at the junior high school and live with 8 African-American orphans who had between the ages of like 15 and 18, who were wards of the state, and the community organization was giving them a place to live. So it was a mind-blowing time.
as you know from our conversation, I come from a very Eastern Rose Garden, white privileged Park Avenue point of view, and living with these young, uneducated, you know, sweet, sincere orphans was 24/7 was just incredible. And I was very angry. I was very sad. I was very lonely. I never was very afraid until one day I came back to, there were two incidents that are worth noting. We had a television, and I remember watching the Democratic National Convention with the kids. I had asked the pastor if I could go. Chicago and Detroit are obviously not very far away, and I knew a lot of people who were going to that convention, and he said, no, you know, we need you here. So I ended up not being able to go. And if you remember any of the news, I mean, it was, in fact, they were talking about it recently when Trump was invading Washington. But these images on the TV of Abraham Ribicoff saying there's a revolution outside, they're kidding, they're clubbing, you know, Americans. And Mayor Daley standing up at the convention and giving Ribicoff the finger. And I'm watching this with these kids, and I'm just like, my blood is boiling and my pulse is racing, and I want to run at the TV set. And they're laughing. They're going, hey, what's the big deal? This is what happens to us all the time. I'll never forget that. And one day I went back to my room. My only valuable values was my camera. And I had a room on the first floor which had which I could lock. And I would lock whenever I would leave. And I had bars on the window to the outside. And I came home, and the door was to my room was slightly open. And I remember locking it. And I looked at all the other kids, and I said, what's happening? And they just kind of didn't have anything to say. So I opened up the door to my room, and I, my camera wasn't where I left it, but the window was locked. The bars were there. So I felt that there was somebody in the room. I opened up my closet, and there was this kid. He was not one of my roommates, but he was a kid who would hang out with us all the time. He was about 16 years old, and he was looking, you know, like a shit-eating grin on his face. And I said, where's my camera? And he said he had handed it through the window to his brother. And I said to him, get it back or I'm going to have you arrested. So he went out, and I did get the camera back. But the next night I was walking home, and it was night, and I saw coming at me six, you know, black teenagers, one of whom was the brother of the kid who I had caught, who was a big guy. He was, you know, bigger than me, and four other guys, and they were just laughing and talking, and we were about 100 yards away from each other, and I was walking toward them, and they were walking toward me. And I remember thinking I could just turn around and run, but they'd probably run after me and beat the shit out of me. Or I would just walk right through them. I would just go straight, look at them, and, you know, in a sense, challenge them to part and let me through. And it really was probably the most frightening moment of my life, but I was too, you know, courage. There's nothing about courage. You just do what your instinct tells you. And I walked right through them like I was a crazy person. And as soon as I passed them, I just kept going, and they started laughing and making fun of me, but they didn't come after me. And, you know, after that, I realized that I actually moved out of the house at that point and moved upstairs so I would be by myself. But the whole rest of the time, I was living above these kids, you know, locking the doors. But pretty, it was the first time I realized that there was danger. But I taught at the school, and it was a very depressing thing because I was teaching junior high, and these kids, they didn't know how to read. They didn't know how to do math. The community organization was a little bit of a scam because the guy who ran it, whose name was Reverend Everhard, he was going to run for city council. And that was really the reason he had this organization. It was kind of a little bit of a front so he could talk about all of his good works. I was realizing how little one could do to solve the problem, just one-on-one. And, here's where the story, digresses a little. Once again, it's a cold winter, and it was a very lonely time. And I made some friends who went to the University of Michigan. And so on weekends, I would sometimes go out there just to be among my own people and watch movies. And I had a girlfriend. And I got to know a guy named Dean Jangle. At the time, I was very unaware of homosexuality or anything like that. But I knew, you know, I knew that it existed. At Hotchkiss, if you were accused of being gay, it was the worst thing that you could be accused of. And Dean had a best friend named Alan Wisniewski. And Alan was one of those, Alan attended, Wayne State, which was in Detroit. And he was this brilliant Jewish kid, but really, really out there, real, almost crazy, when he would talk about politics and revolution and stuff like that. And I never got very close to him, but Dean was close to him. And we started a group, it was sort of SDS / meets guerrilla theater. And we'd get together and we'd, and again, this is me trying to do something outside of the depressingness of that community organization. And we would have meetings and then we'd go around the city and we'd do this sort of agitprop guerrilla theater stuff. And Alan would constantly come up with these ideas, and I'd say, Alan, you know, we could get arrested for that. And he'd say, yeah, wouldn't that be cool? And I'd say, I don't think that would be cool, and I'd lose, you know, my deferment, and I would be drafted, so no, let's not do that. But one day, and it turned out to be Yom Kippur, which I didn't particularly celebrate, but I knew what it was, we were going to have a meeting. And I went to it, and Alan wasn't there, but Dean was literally white as a sheet. I said, what happened? Something happened? And he said, I just got off the phone. Alan walked into his temple where he had this rabbi who was pretty well known, named Rabbi Adler. And Alan starts yelling, you people are such fucking hypocrites. You call yourself good Jews. You go to temple 3 days a year. All you care about is where you're sitting. You don't give a shit about the war in Vietnam. You don't give a shit about the people who live 2 miles away from you. And he's yelling this at the top of his lungs and, you know, created quite a
a furor, and his Rabbi Adler walks toward him and starts saying, "Alan, you've got to calm down." And then Dean tells me, "Alan pulled out a gun." And I thought to myself, holy shit, that's taking guerrilla theater way too far. Alan points it at Rabbi Adler. People start screaming, yelling. And then Alan pulled the trigger and shot Rabbi Adler in the head and shot himself. And at that moment, they were both, Dean said, they're in the hospital. They're both in comas. They're in adjoining hospital rooms, which I thought was sort of noteworthy. And the next day, they both died. So I never obviously forgot about that. Again, I digress and say that after a few years, I was admitted to the American Film Institute. And I was a particularly unself-confident person. And so I was really not sure whether I had what it would take to stay in the film business. Our first year, we made all these short films, and we would show them to each other, and mine were terrible. And I really didn't know whether I was good enough to become a filmmaker. But my films were getting better, but they were still pretty terrible. So we had the opportunity in our second year to make a short film if it got approved. And I'm thinking about stories, and I'm realizing that I really am not a good enough writer to come up with an original idea, but maybe if I find a short story, I can adapt it. So I'm reading all these short stories by all these writers, and there's this writer I discover named Joyce Carol Oates, and she's from Windsor, Ontario, which is right across the river from Detroit, and she says that she teaches at the University of Detroit. So I'm reading this book of her short stories, and there's a short story in it called In the Region of Ice, which is about a nun who teaches Shakespeare at a Catholic university in Detroit, and her relationship with a student and who tests her faith. And at the end of the story, he commits suicide. And I thought, this is an amazing short story, but I could see this as a movie. I mean, I'd make it in black and white, set it in Detroit. You know, I knew it. I knew what would go on the walls. And also it was about religion, which I studied at Dartmouth. It's about Shakespeare, which I'd majored in, and it's about suicide, which I'd been very interested in intellectually and emotionally. And so I thought it was perfect. So how to get the rights to it? I remembered when I was in Detroit, I become friendly with this priest named Father Porter, who taught film at the University of Detroit. And so I called him and I said, "Do you know Joyce Carol Oates? It says that she teaches at the University of Detroit." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, she wrote a short story that I'd like to get the rights for." And he said, "Yeah, I know her, but, you know, she's never let anybody do any of her films, any of her short stories or books into film." And I said, "Well, I can't pay her, so I might as well just ask." And he said, "Sure, I'll give you her information. Just out of curiosity, what's the name of the short story?" And I said, "It's called In the Region of Ice." And there was a sort of a pause. And he says, "Of all the short stories, that's the one that she never let anybody do." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, it's sort of autobiographical. It's based on her own relationship with one of her students. She wrote it, sent it off to the Atlantic Monthly. They accepted it. And then something happened, and she tried to have it withdrawn from publication, but it was too late. So I don't think she'd want a movie made out of it." I said, "Do you know what happened?" And he said, "Yes, I do. As I said, it's based on her relationship with one of her students. And
And in the short story, the boy commits suicide, but it turns out that the real boy went out and shot a rabbi and then shot himself.
Wow.
It was Richard. And I wrote her and I told her about my, you know, my relationship and knowledge of Richard, and asked her if she would give me the rights, and she did. And I wrote 17 drafts, spent probably 6 months prepping, making, posting the movie. It was cost $15,000. We shot it in black and white, 35 millimeter. It was an incredible experience shooting it with a group of my friends. And to my surprise, it turned out pretty well. And so sent it off to the New York Film Festival. And to my surprise, they showed it. And since it was shown at the New York Film Festival, I figured, well, we might as well see if we can apply to the Academy and see if it can get screened for there. And to my surprise, it was nominated. And to my great surprise, it won an Oscar.
Well, that's incredible.
So that, you know, again, Detroit and Vista completely changed my life.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think that's so interesting. This is not, I mean, it's sort of a personal story for you too. I mean, as much as it is autobiographical for her, for
yes.
Carol Oates, for Joyce Carol Oates, maybe that, and I'm sure that this probably is to some extent the passion and the work and the, you know, obviously the product of what you were able to make there. Do you feel like your personal knowledge of the situation of those involved, that really influenced that, you know, the work you put in and what you were able to make?
Oh, very much. And I think that as film has changed, you know, going from those 70s films to Jaws and Star Wars and, you know, blockbusters and stuff like that, I think in general it's gotten much less political. I would say that probably Godfather or Star Wars are very personal movies, and that's part of why they're so successful. But I think that the films that I've made, the television movies that I've made, the feature I did about Vietnam, the best work I've done, and I'm very proud of many of these movies, is because they were personal. I really cared about the subjects, whether they were Lyndon Johnson or Hiroshima, or, you know, I made a film that was nominated by the Television Academy called Why I Wore Lipstick to My Mastectomy, which was a kind of a comedy about cancer. But I got very close to the woman who wrote it, who I'm still friendly with. And, you know, that's our relationship. You and I have a relationship to the Shrivers. I was asked to do a film for Hallmark Hall of Fame about a young man who had Tourette's and became the Georgia State Teacher of the Year, and was produced by Tim Shriver, who's the son of Sergeant Shriver, who started the Peace Corps and Vista. And so it was a very personal connection to Timmy, and it ended up being a wonderful, wonderful movie that also was, you know, nominated for many awards. So where I've been able to connect my the things that I care about, the thing that I empathize with and identify with to my work, is the best work I've done. And obviously tremendously rewarding career to be able to say that about what you love.
Yeah. I mean, It really is incredible, especially here to hear the trajectory of, you know, your work, how something like, you know, the Vietnam War draft might have sort of domino effect that, you know, led you to be a part of VISTA to make the Region of Ice, which helps, you know, your career itself. And I think there really is a lot there that, you know, we talked about how this specifically is the, you know, the Dartmouth Vietnam project, and people sometimes wonder, you know, does that mean that you're only looking for students who served in the war, or you're looking for veterans themselves? And really, there clearly is a whole lot more to it, that, you know, the war and the social environment of the time, there's so much interconnected and important thing that led you to have, you know, just as integral and fascinating of a role that sort of sparked your career, you know, obviously that was a springboard to so much of, as you said, your best work, things that you felt really connected to. And I do think that's really incredible.
Well, that's right. I'm very excited to hear about your project because, you know, to some extent, the after effect, the sort of the one line about how America responded to Vietnam was, yeah, it was a bad war, but, you know, the people who fought there were heroes. And the people, you know, and America turned very law and order with Nixon. And the people who were against the war, they were considered draft dodgers, which isn't quite as noble as fallen heroes. So I thought, oh, this is going to be another project about, you know, the unfortunate, tragic lives of people who died, you know, in our class, or, you know, or people like my brother-in-law who were against the war, but fought it and nobly and came home and spoke against it. So it was really interesting to me that you're including the VISTA volunteers and the Peace Corps people who, and you know, I can, as I said, my experience was pretty scary and pretty depressing in some ways, but also it changed my life and I know made me a better human being. And also hopefully in the long run, I contributed through my movies to a certain kind of consciousness.
Yeah. No, and I think that's, you know, one of the most rewarding parts about this is that I think, you know, as students of history, you know, people who are, you try to see the entire scope of things. And I think a really great thing, which you just reflected on there, is that, you know, the war forced you to see things, you know, for some it was to look out and to go to Vietnam or go to Southeast Asia or serve somewhere far away, see the outward, you know, effect of the U.S. But also it's so interesting to me that in the very same way was able to send you to look sort of more internally to the U.S. and to see, you know, you know, Park Avenue, that's a pretty different street than the one you worked in Detroit, right? But that, it's a level of reflection to see different parts of the United States in that way, which I think is really incredible. And an interesting part that, as you know, the history of the war and for the United States was truly was multifaceted. And that really is a cool part about it to look back.
Well, it seems like, in a sense, I think I've given you most of the stories. I'm not sure how many others are worth sharing, but I would conclude by saying that this is as exciting and interesting and horrifying and revolutionary a time as when I graduated in 1960,
8, and now my son is graduating into this pandemic, George Floyd, Black Lives Matter moment, and it's going to be scary for him to find a job. Fortunately or unfortunately, he wants to be a filmmaker. But I also think it's an incredible time for young people who don't have the same expectations of how the film business used to be, and they're going to create their own films and their own industry, and it's going to be difficult because of the pandemic, et cetera, but it's pretty exciting in the same way that that time ended up being very exciting for me.
Right. Yeah. I think that there really is, out of all these really chaotic and difficult times, I think you do see a lot of life-changing work and really.
Right. And maybe a sort of a 70s type cinema that grew out of the 60s will come, you know, in the next 10 years.
Yeah. And I guess one last maybe reflection that you might have. I noticed that it was really interesting. You said, you know, at least at your time at Dartmouth and sort of going forward, that there were those who were pro-war and those who were anti-war and they're, you know, left and right, and how there wasn't, and I think you said this, right, that there wasn't the same sort of vitriol between the groups, and that it didn't feel, and that you could come up and then, you know, still get lunch together afterwards. How do you think, you know, looking at that in terms of what you see today, that, you know, it doesn't always necessarily feel that way nowadays? I don't know if you have any reflections on that. I just think that your time and experience are invaluable in sort of your interpretation.
Well, in a way, I turn that back to you because I, you know, you tell me what it's like on campus. I mean, is the campus as divided as the society is? Is it Fox versus, you know, MSNBC and CNN and, you know, red state versus blue state? Or is there some kind of recognition of the community and the need to sort of pull together as a college and as a country?
Yeah, and that's really interesting. Obviously, we're not on campus right now. It feels, you know, different in a certain way there. But you, as a filmmaker, as someone who's producing things for large audiences, and I think you have a good understanding that I think news and sort of social media and a lot of other really public things are ways that we can interact now that, you know, you might not have had before to the same degree between students.
Yeah, but social media seems to be as divisive as
right. Right. Exactly. And I mean, as a platform to publicize sort of thoughts and opinions. And I would say that, you know, it varies. And I think, but at Dartmouth, you know, it feels, and this is obviously super, you know, subjective, what I've felt, it feels like people are generally on a similar page, and that there's, you know, this has been a really powerful enough week or two that people seem, you know, it just kind of stops everyone and says, wait a minute, something's going on here. Granted, I can't speak to, you know, beyond what Dartmouth feels like, or, you know, to other parts of the nation, or, you know, places where it's less of a sort of a uniform opinion there. But yeah, I mean, what I thought was interesting was your words about how people were able to, you know, be friendly to one another despite these like pretty fundamental differences in opinions after the fact. And I think, you know, maybe less so at a really educated and, you know, place where there's a lot of conversations, you know, like Dartmouth. It still does feel like in terms of the country as a whole, it's not, you know, it seems like pretty polarized at the moment.
Yeah.
So, right. And I think
it's a pretty, I mean, it's exciting, but it's also scary. It's
I think we still believed in the value of discussion. I'm not saying we're better by any means, because obviously the racism and the sexism and were huge compared to today. But I also feel that the wokeness has polarized the situation even more. And, you know, God willing, and, you know, Trump is defeated, but, you know, one wonders whether that's going to go down peaceably, you know, with his base, and, you know, what will happen to the next president in terms of governing. It's a scary, exciting, dramatic time. That's all I can say. And I'm sure glad I'm here to watch it, because as a student of history and a student of drama, you couldn't have more drama.
Right. No, I think that this, this is a time where you are truly seeing such a momentous, you know, occasion. And I think for you too, it's a special experience. It's special for me to be able to hear and interview you here, and especially people from like the class of 68, people born in the mid to late 40s, that you saw, that you came of age and were a young person in another time that felt so powerfully chaotic, but also, you know, some sort of progress being made, and you know, you get to see it again, and how it, maybe it cycles of it, but it is truly a pretty incredible thing to witness, at least, at the very least.
Well, thank you very much for having me for this interview. I really will treasure getting a copy of it, because I'm sure it's something that my children will hopefully value.
Of course, thank you, and thank you so much for being here today.